talk given on Sunday, July 18th, 1971. I wonder if you were able to put into practice what we considered last time. Shall I put the question in another way? Are we now all free of all our problems? If not, why not? Now, you remember what we considered carefully, very carefully, last time. The essential point that as and when any problem arises, do not take sides. Because as long as we take sides for one aspect of the problem as against another, we are in a state of conflict. The end of the conflict may be a conquest. But all conquest, whatsoever it may be, and all conflict, whatsoever it may be, breeds further conflict. There is no end to that. Do consider this matter very deeply. Because this is the real key to inward peace and harmony. The peace and harmony no one can ever take away from you, and which will enable you to be a power for good in the world by your mere existence, without your lifting a finger. You see, as long as I myself am in a state of conflict, taking sides with any one thing against another, I can never be a source of harmony. For the very simple reason that as long as conflict subsists, there is no understanding. I don't mean understanding in the limited sense. In a limited particular context, you have two aspects to consider, and you have to come to some decision, and you can easily come to a decision where that is concerned. But wheresoever any real conflict arises in one, if you take sides, you take sides because some bias, prejudice, some assumption, some preconception, some desire, passion, whim, appetite, some repression, some resentment has moved us to take that particular side against the other. Under all these conditions, there is absolutely no possibility of real harmony. The harmony which is not the temporary cold war between two hot wars. The real harmony is something which is permanent, because oneself is free from all those sources of disharmony which lie within oneself. This is the great point about it. When the mind ceases to take sides, it sees all aspects. And in the seeing of all aspects, which is always accompanied by patience, by deep compassion for all concerned, understanding of the whole situation comes into being, and the whole situation is harmonized from within oneself. And that is the only extent to which one can release harmony into one's environment. If the environment, in this environment, there are other people involved who continue to be disharmonious, I can't do anything about them. I can't compel them, that is. I can only inspire them by what I myself can do. If I myself remain a source of harmony, because I'm harmonious within my own being, at peace, a whole being, then that will inevitably have its influence upon the other people concerned. But in relation to the situation as a whole, which includes me as well as the other people, at least there is one source of harmony, of true harmony, that is oneself. Because one doesn't take sides. And one is no longer, therefore, in a state of conflict. This is very, very important. Consider, what is the meaning of the word problem? How and why does a problem arise? Is not a problem something in relation to which my mind is not quite clear? My mind is in a state of confusion, a state of ignorance, a state of incapacity. So long as that is the case, so long as my own mind is in a state of confusion, whatever the situation throws up is a problem for me. Now we mustn't think that if I do find clarity in myself, therefore all problems will cease, not at all. Every situation throughout life, for anybody and everybody, continuously throws out a series of challenges, simply because that is the nature of the becoming process. Where there is a process of growth, of expansion, of diminution, of interplay, interaction, challenges are constantly thrown up by factors which are known as well as unforeseen. Now, in our own minds, how do we define the word challenge? Do we not all immediately feel something which is in opposition to us? This is a challenge. Right from childhood, we grow up like that. The other fellow comes and says to me, I'll challenge you for a fight or something. He's in opposition to me. I'll challenge you to a game of this, that or the other. I'll challenge you to a race. Opposition. So the mind grows up with a sense of opposition associated with the word challenge. But actually a challenge is a particular kind of stimulus. It is a stimulus. Am I going merely to react as an ignorant, incapable man to the stimulus? Or am I going to respond to it wisely, compassionately. This is the difference. Now, life continuously throws up challenges. That's the nature of the becoming process. No one can alter that. So, when the challenge comes, if I don't take sides, I understand the whole of that challenge, all the factors that are involved. And with patience, with skill, with love, the right response can come out. And that is the harmonizing influence. It is always accompanied by action, remember. Except in those cases where the challenge doesn't concern anything physical at all. Any technical procedure required or any other physical procedure required. Excepting in those cases, physical action will always accompany wise perception. And that physical action will be spontaneous. It will be just the right thing. And that's the end of it. As far as you're concerned, you pass on. It is complete and finished. Finished in the sense of the craftsman's finishing a thing. Perfectly finished. You see, do consider this very deeply. Every day, as every challenge comes up, no taking sides. It's easy to say it to oneself. It's very difficult to do because unconsciously all our conditioning, together with all our prejudices and assumptions on the one hand, that is intellectually, and our desires and passions and greeds and everything on the other hand, both sets of forces come to make us decide one for one against the other. So watch this carefully. Now, if we watch this really carefully, the mind becomes healthy. Why? Because watching what rises up within, all this conditioning and all these forces which rise up within, in reaction against that which with which we are faced, enables us to understand the whole of our own self as well as the nature of the circumstance, the true nature of the circumstance. There are so many people who say, oh, I'm a hard-headed, shrewd fellow. Nothing of the sort. The man's as big a fool as any other fool in the world. Nothing of the sort. He does not understand. No person with a conditioned mind truly understands. He has a confused conception of the thing, a misconception. Let's have no illusions about this. We are full of conceits, simply because we love ourselves egoistically. See, we have to see with an eye which is utterly clear. We have to see the truth about ourselves, absolutely, unsparingly. And then the healthy mind is present in operation. And as we saw last time, the healthy mind is the happy mind. Just as the healthy body is the happy body. This is so important, so important. If each one of us cannot be a healthy, happy mind, it is futile trying to make anybody else happy. Or trying to do things for others. We ourselves are clumsy, incapable. What are we rushing about trying to do things for others for? It cannot be done. You see. So do look into this. When one considers things this way, the question is often asked, but isn't this a thoroughly selfish viewpoint? You're only concerned with your own mind and getting it balanced and harmonious and all the rest of it. Well, the simplest and the most straightforward answer is, first try it and realize it and see if you will ask the question after you have realized what has been put forth. But we may consider the answer right now. There is no such thing possible. It is absolutely impossible for anyone to consider oneself alone and realize perfection or harmony. Everything happens in relationship with other people, with animals, with the plant world, with the whole world, in fact. We are constantly in interaction and interrelationship. We cannot cut it out. Whatever we want to do. Take the extreme case of the hermits and others who just retired into the desert or the jungle or something. Well, all right. They went away from one part of the world, which we call a village or a town or a city, into another part of the world, which we call a desert or a jungle. But wherever they went, they were in the world. And the whole world supported them. Air and sun and shade and light and everything else was there. You can't cut yourself off from the world. Perfectly futile. So there's no such thing as realizing, as coming to fruition in any respect for oneself alone. It's quite impossible. We are always affecting something, somebody else also with it. And we are affected by what is around us. So there's no selfishness involved in it. The reality of selfishness exists in our isolative self-consciousness. Insofar as I'm constantly concerned, I'm conscious only of my own interests and my own self as such. And in consequence of that, I act constantly, all day long, in a destructive manner, trying to shut myself off from the rest of the world. Therein lies selfishness. So now, this thing, happiness, like love, like wisdom, truth, goodness, anything, is a universal reality. It is not anybody's possession. It is not anybody's prize, a reward for something done. For these things, which we call goodness, truth, beauty, and so forth, are names to describe the one and only reality, mind itself. Wisdom, truth, goodness, love, happiness are other names for mind itself. Mind which is unsullied, which is not cluttered up. In the ordinary way, we clutter up mind. The clutter we may more or less legitimately call my mind. But when my mind, the clutter, is out, there is no longer my mind. There is only mind. This mysterious sensitivity which belongs to the living organism. Yourself, myself, as we commonly say. And this is empty. What is it empty of? It's empty of rubbish. All my ideas and misconceptions and my follies and all the rest of it. It's empty of all that. And when it is empty of all that, what happens? It is full of light, clarity, understanding. The power of understanding flows out then from the living being because his sensitivity, which is mind, is now functioning unhindered. That is all. Supposing I had rheumatism, arthritis in my hands and fingers, how well can I play the piano? But once that clutter of arthritis is out, it's a different story, isn't it? It's just like that. It's as simple as that. And it's as lovely as that. There is no happiness comparable to happiness in this sense. The healthy mind is the happy mind, and so forth. Then it is not mine, not yours, it is universal. You see, one keeps crying for methods, for systems. What have you got to do? Lay down a scheme. I am only a beginner. I am never anything but a beginner. Where is the beginning? When is the beginning? Where and when is the ending? As far as the total reality is concerned. Totality has neither beginning nor ending. And each one of us is a miniature of totality. There is no point in saying, I am only a beginner. This is an excuse. An excuse which is perfectly natural. It emerges justifiably, because I'm ignorant. See? So I say I'm a beginner. All right, supposing we start with that, with the mistaken statement, I'm a beginner. What steps do I take? There is only one step which I have to take. And that one step includes every other step as we commonly describe the process. All the steps on the way, as people commonly say, are variations of the one and only step. When you're marching, or if you're playing a piece of music, you beat time, don't you? 1, 2, 3, 4, or 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, or whatever it is. And you say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and you count a lot of figures. But what is all that counting? Oh, beating time. What is all that beating time? It's the one rhythm of music. But the rhythm is one only. You can't split up rhythm into quantities. You get it? So, it is the same with the what we call the religious life. It is the same with what we call realizing perfection or coming to fruition or releasing our full and true humanity. It is but one thing alone, and all the other things added on or subtracted from, etc., which seem to be separate other things, are all part and parcel of the one thing, the one step. How shall we present this one step? Which way shall we understand its oneness? It's the rock bottom unity, so to say. The source, which is also the goal. I have time and again talked about this in the past. The whole story of our spiritual progress and fulfillment is a story of the transformation of our awareness of existence. In which manner are we conscious of existence? You remember, I have often given this simile. There is a clergyman and a tailor and a soldier, we'll say, traveling in a bus, and they come to a bus stop and they see 20 other people waiting, and the soldier is aware of them in terms of so many possible soldiers, the tailor in terms of so many possible suits, and the clergyman in terms of so many possible souls to be saved. That is the manner in which people are aware of existence. Now that is obviously the conditioned, the limited, the petty, the absurd manner. This is the worldly manner. This is worldliness. This kind of awareness of our existence. Now this has to undergo the transformation. It is put in Mahayana Buddhism in a wonderful way. This turning about in the innermost seat of consciousness. This turning about, that is how it is translated. I would prefer to call it, present it like this. It is a turning inside out in the innermost seat of consciousness. We look at everything externally, on the surface. The clergyman sees so many souls to be saved, the tailor sees so many suits to be made, when he sees 20 human beings, you see. That is looking at it from the outside. And the number of outsides is absolutely multitudinous. We just can't tackle this multitude of outsides as they are. The temporal passing appearances. Something is born, grows, dies. Something comes into being, proceeds, and passes away. We can't tackle it from that end. But supposing we look at it from the inside. The inside is just one inside of all the multitudinous outsides. This inside, this ground of our being, as such, is empty, it's transparent, it is no thing, it is undifferentiated but holds within itself the possibility of infinite differentiations because it is creative power. Now, this is what the theistic people call conversion. When a person experiences conversion, this is what happens. A transformation in his mode of awareness. All of you who have been born and brought up in a Christian milieu very well know St. Paul, for example. Saul of Tarsus, who was the oppressor, undergoes this transformation and becomes Paul the Apostle. This transformation of consciousness. This is the one and only step. Everything else that happens is but a variation of this one and only step. You will, of course, ask the inevitable question, how do I take this step? Where do I put my foot? No, you don't lift one foot and put it forward. You don't. You jump. You jump, you plunge with your whole being into the emptiness. You see, without this, all the outsides, the disciplines, the methods, the practices, are just outsides, and they remain outsides, and they don't produce that vital, creative, living change in your inner being, which means that you have realized that the kingdom of heaven is here, that nirvana is right within, that enlightenment is our natural condition. We remain in the unnatural state, the spoilt state. Dukkha, far from the infinite, the sorrowing, suffering state. This is the one and only step. You plunge. Now, oh, but I'm afraid to plunge. Well, then stay behind. No one can push you into that emptiness. No one can do it for you. Why? Each one of us is an individual, and it is not given by the good God. You can blame him if you like. You see? It's not given by any power or anywhere in the universe for any one individual to compel another to make this plunge. You have to do it on your own. It cannot be done by outside agency. It can only be done by yourself. Do you care for it? Then you will plunge freely. You know how mad lovers are. Exactly. We've got to be mad as that. Real, completely mad. And in that complete madness, we discover the perfect sanity, the truth, where this is concerned. Leave aside all this worldly madness. This divine intoxication is a different thing. If you cannot care, if you're afraid, if you shrink back, if you hold on to your little worldlinesses in all sorts of shapes and forms, your beliefs, your ideas, and your little desires and indulgences and all the rest of it. All right, carry on. We are born, we live a few years, we die. So much stuff swept aside. Didn't work out. So you just sweep it aside and life throws up innumerable new creatures. It's unconcerned. God, who is life, is quite unconcerned. God, who is God, is totally concerned also. But this mystery you will understand if you take the plunge. Why is it that we find it difficult to remember and to practice during the fortnights? In between. Consider carefully. Consider. Are we preoccupied with our own little thoughts and desires and activities? You know, it's a little bit like this. Have you ever kept your eyes open, really open, and looked at the marvelous beauty of light and sun and everything which one can see in this vast city of London itself? See, I've lived in this country 50 years now. 50 years. Golden Jubilee on the 10th of September. And in these 50 years, I have had ample time and opportunity to watch the crowds as they move about in London. What are they looking at? How are they looking? How are they moving about through the streets? And all the time there might be the most marvelous sunshine or the beauty of cloud and color and this, that and the other. And they are utterly blind to this divinity which is present all the time. This is the case with us. But this has always been the case with all of us through time. The few who realized, declared, God is omnipresent. Or if you don't want the theistic word, the absolute, the void, the ultimate truth, the perfect, the ultimate reality, or whatever you like to call it. Infinite love, use any sound you like, you see. It is present all the time here, now. Which one of us is awake and responsive to that? The infinite, the source of all things, the sustainer. And it will take us back into itself without a word, without a murmur. Without a regret that we failed to respond. This is the marvel. This is infinite love. This is the divinity of love. No recriminations, no judgments. It is also the divinity of love that it does not prevent the natural consequence of my wrongdoing to come upon me. Because if it did, how would my eyes open? If I will insist upon walking into a brick wall, I will never learn not to walk into a brick wall if all the time I'm prevented by somebody. Get a little sense knocked into one sometimes. This has to be the case. But that is also the divinity of divine love. That it allows the aspect of rigor in the universal process to function. So now, you have to take the plunge freely and completely, without fear. We have learnt fear with respect to taking plunges, first and foremost from the very beginning in our childhood, by virtue of the fact that there is a thing called gravity. And if he plunged in the wrong way, it would hurt very badly. So you see, this is our very first lesson with respect to taking the plunge or jumping. Or even taking a step. We take our steps gingerly and carefully until we see a puddle. Then we go both feet in straight away. We are so clever. And then we learn to swim and we realize that in this fluid medium, which is less resistant and less hurtful than the solid medium, earth, we begin to get a little more courageous and we can play about with this medium. But we can never fly in the air with our bodies. We can't do that. So we are very, very careful that we are never in such a position that we will suddenly find ourselves precipitated through the air. So you see, there is this element of caution, of fear associated, which is absolutely necessary for safeguarding the body, which is absolutely necessary for preventing ourselves from being a nuisance to those around us when there's a terrible mess because we decided to jump out of the 33rd floor. But now, consider. Supposing we could jump into outer space freely. Assuming that there'll be air and all the rest of it so that the body will be alive and won't become weightless and troubled. Just assuming that. There is no fall. What is there to fall into? Nothing at all, which will hurt. And we could jump quite fearlessly, can't we? Now, in our actual lives, we do that in one situation. We jump without any fear. Do you remember your dreams when you suddenly knew, I am dreaming, and off you go into space? Just like that. And the real ecstasy of it. And then the slight disappointment when you wake up, oh, it was only a dream. It was so lovely, flying in the air. Now, where the spirit is concerned, there is no death. In the sense of the ending of life, none at all. Where the spirit is concerned, it is life continuous. And what can plunge into this infinitude of spirit but the mind which is so filled with love? The whole consciousness which is moved by this overriding passion to make the plunge into that ocean of the spirit. And there is no falling, there is no hurt. There is extraordinary poise and peace and happiness. This is true. These words are not wishful thinking. They are not the vaporings of an idealist. This is plain, straightforward fact. If you have eaten bananas, you know exactly what eating bananas means and is like. And whatsoever a person who has never seen or heard of or tasted or tried to eat a banana, whatsoever he says to you, contrary to your own living experience, you can just silently smile at. Isn't that so? So now, it's the same with the spirit. It is like that. In this spirit, I use the word spirit. You can just as well use the word mind. Buddhism is particularly fond of using the word mind, and mind only, all along the line. See? Others use the word soul or spirit. And even in Buddhism, for instance, a writer like Suzuki constantly uses the word soul. See, it's a convenient word in the English language, obviously. So this is the step. This plunge. And in this plunging, this transformation of awareness proceeds apace. And in this transformed awareness, one's sensitivity has grown far more intense. The result is that all pleasure and pain are felt and experienced much more powerfully than ever before. You become very much more sensitive. But if you are sensible, you also have proportionately greater strength from within. Perception, understanding. You know, no, yes, yes, this is all right. And you go on. See, I always feel concerned with getting at the heart of things. Our life is like a vast mansion with endless rooms, so to say, you see. And if I go turning the switch on for every single room, why, I'll take my whole lifetime lighting up this vast mansion. But if I can put my finger on the main switch, the whole mansion gets lit up. That's that. Finished. And this is the best way. Love at first sight and go all for it. Absolutely. But see that you have seen the right one. Otherwise you'll have trouble. And I see, as every challenge in our situation in life comes up, don't say, I've got a problem. This is the immediate situation, right? See the whole of it. Patiently, persistently. Look. Watch the intellectual clutter that comes up in terms of assumptions, preconceptions, criteria, judgments, evaluations. Just watch how they operate. Watch how the desires come up in association with that which is in the immediate now. Watch those two here, watch the circumstance. As and where necessary, physical action has to be performed, perform it. See? But watch the mind as it impels us to the physical action. because the nature of the action will depend upon my desires, my emotions, my conditioning. Watch that. And in the watching, if the watching is complete and total, there'll be complete purity involved where the mind is concerned. There'll be complete purity impelling us to the action. And then there's every chance that the action will be the right action. More than that, one can't do anything. That is the best possible under the circumstance. Therefore, we do it that way. So then, no taking sides, and understanding and compassion will well out and make you do the right thing. You won't need to go and ask somebody else or run here, run there, what do you think I ought to do? If I were asked that and I had to give the short, sharp, terse answer, only two words, be quiet. Don't ask questions like that of another person. This is your responsibility. Stand on your feet and do the job. Consider together, yes. It's a different matter. Because here, in considering together, one is releasing or trying to release true understanding. But considering together is a very different thing from asking advice with the intention, and this is always the case, of picking out those elements which you had already thought of and which support your own actual desire of the moment and discarding the rest. And if what you can pick out is in fair quantity, you'll say, oh, he was a very good chap, he gave me such good advice, you know. Do see into all these things. And you know, this is the first step, the only step, which carries one the whole way. Shall we have a glimpse of the end of the way? The end which is at the beginning also. Shall we take a glimpse of it? Recall this small word which has been treasured by mankind in various forms throughout the ages. In the English language, that word is God. What does that word signify? What does it stand for? Leave alone intellectual definitions. Has any one of us ever realized even a fragment of what that word stands for? Mere beliefs, mere conceptions are just pictures. They are clouds up there in the sky. Not realities here now in the room. What does that word stand for? In that word is summed up all that man can envision as regards his own fruition and fulfillment. In that single word. Christianity is a religion which has steadfastly separated God the Creator and man the created. And they won't have it that man is God and God is man. And yet, the greatest of Christian mystics have constantly said this kind of thing, that man is God and God is man, in truth, in reality.
Eckhart has said it. Only this afternoon, I happened to open Eckhart. I think it's page 194 of the Evans edition of the first volume. Man is God, and God is man. No man has seen God as an object. I don't mean merely a material object. As an object of any sort. Because an object is limited, finite, particular, mortal. And none of those terms apply to God. To the infinite, the absolute. But that infinite is completely embodied in this, the finite man. Man being endowed with freedom, but unhappily starting in ignorance, has raised up so many screens between himself and this infinite. But when man becomes purified, and with the process of purification awakens to the truth, the reality about himself to start with, and about the multitudinous particulars as such, then seeing from the inside, he sees God. The essential oneness, the essential fundamental reality, which is immeasurable, which has no characteristics, no qualifications, but out of which arise differentiation and characteristics and qualities and all the rest of it. He sees that. And so, when he has tried to communicate this transformation of his own consciousness from the finite into the infinite, from the mortal into the immortal, he has been compelled to use only those words which belong to the realm of the mortal and the finite, because the dictionaries of the world don't have words where the infinite is concerned. Words are descriptive simply because they refer to the finite, to the particular, to the mortal. When they do not refer to the finite, the mortal, the incomplete, so to say, then the words are nondescript. And a nondescript word cannot tell the brain anything whatsoever. But the nondescript word can produce a peculiar thrill in one's being, because we have this sensitivity called mind, the universal. This sensitive which we have, mind, the infinite, the universal, thrills to the nondescript sound. What are the nondescript sounds? Absolute. Infinite. Immortal. These are things which the brain doesn't know and can never know. Because the brain can know only in terms of defining, limiting. But other than brain is this extraordinary sensitivity which is mind. And this thrills in response to the nondescript sound. Just as it thrills to the inner feeling which is associated with the all, the absolute, the totality. And one just sort of, the organism reacts to that sometimes by a sigh, sometimes by saying, "Oh, my God, my goodness." Now, when I say "my goodness" in that way, I'm not referring to goodness or my goodness or anything at all. These are nondescript sounds to express infinity. See? So the word God is this nondescript sound to express the absoluteness. The source out of which emerges all this appearance, the total cosmos. Now, that word represents our ending. Not ending in the sense of death, but our ending of all travail, the ending of all unfulfillment, the ending of all confusion, of greed and hate and stupidity and ambition, clumsiness and mismanagement. That is the word. It's not the only word. You can use other words. And if you want it in terms of human characteristics, look at this, which comes out of the Zarathustrian scriptures, in what is called the Ahura Mazda Yast. Yast is a long sort of hymn of praise plus an attempt to convey the transcendent reality. Ahura Mazda as God, the transcendent reality. Zarathustra, the prophet, asks Ahura Mazda. You know, these things in the old days were always put in the form of the divine dialogue. And God answers, or one of the angels of the Lord answers, as in the Old Testament, and so on and so on. And Zarathustra inquires, what is the nature of the abode of Ahura Mazda? And Ahura Mazda says, "O Zarathustra, here in my abode dwelleth the good mind." That's the first thing he says. The perfect mind. Supreme holiness. Omnipotent power. Divine devotion, wholeness and health, immortality. This am I, says Ahura Mazda. This is how the man Zarathustra, who realized, who was one of the holy ones of the world, the perfected holy ones. This is how he presents his own realization in these terms. But consider these qualities. You can look at the qualities ascribed to the Buddha, for instance, or to Sri Krishna, or any of the many holy ones of the Veda and the Upanishad and so forth. And there are literally scores of such names. I personally know scores of them. See? And what I know of the old scriptures is hardly enough to get me a third class. This is what he says. O Zarathustra, here in my abode dwelleth the good mind, supreme holiness, omnipotent power, divine devotion, wholeness and health, immortality. Vahu Mano, the good mind. Asha, holiness. Kshatra, the power. Armaiti, devotion. Haurvatat, wholeness and health. And Amaratat, immortality. This is in the Avastan language, you see. Then Zarathustra asks, when one is up against evil things, evil people, evil forces, what are the instruments, the weapons with which one can combat them? And Ahura Mazda answers, the divine names are the instruments which you will use. Your protection, your armor against evil. And then he gives his divine names. First and foremost, I who am. Aham asmi. Think of Exodus. Ehye asher ehye. I am that I am, or as sometimes translated, I who am. But please, this I is not the separate little ego. This I is the one and only I, the totality. I who am. The gatherer, the shepherd. The phrase good shepherd, I think, is derived from Zarathustrian teaching and is taken over into the other religions of Western Asia, which sprang up in Western Asia, Christianity and so forth, the good shepherd idea. The all-pervading, the omnipresent one. Supreme holiness again. The whole good creation out of the seed of holiness. One of the divine names. This is our ending, remember. Our finishing, our perfecting. Knowledge and the possessor of knowledge. Of course, this is... there's no time to talk about the distinctions. I must finish this slot. Wisdom and the master of wisdom. Knowledge and the possessor of knowledge. Wisdom and the master of wisdom. One has to differentiate between the two, knowledge and wisdom. And here, of course, in this context, knowledge does not mean, in our worldly sense, the knowledge of algebra or engineering or medicine or not that kind of thing. Prosperity and the bestower of prosperity. Nothing to do with bank balances or maximum production or any such nonsense. Prosperity and the bestower of prosperity. Be fruitful and multiply, as said in the Old Testament. If you are fruitful spiritually, your influence is such that others also flower out spiritually. And so this, be fruitful and multiply, is fulfilled only non-procreatively. Almighty, Lord of life, Justicia, friend of all. Of all, good and bad alike. Invincible, all-seeing, healer, lawgiver, Lord of creation. Those are the names he gives. How does one use these names? Pay attention to the significance of the name. It is the reality of our own being. The immortal reality of our own being is represented in such terms. The divine reality. And not only of our own being, but of all that is. This is our fruition. Such a person who represents what is supremely involved in all these names is the true man, the true human, Son of Man, Son of God, if you like. But look, our starting point is here, isn't it? Jump into the void with your whole being, fearlessly, into the void, the spiritual void, which doesn't mean plunge into any sort of stupid procedure on earth in worldly affairs. Jump into that void. You cannot fall. There is no falling. You are in the immeasurable immensity. Trust it. And watch, hear and now, without taking sides.